Thanks for the invitation and a very kind introduction. Yeah, hope Frank talked about this. I think hopefully today I can give you more details than what Frank already told you. So so today I'm going to tell you this recent work that we have, and also if time permits, I'm going to comment on how this can help us in quantum machine learning, which is the name of the seminar series. And then but please feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions or anything confusing. We don't really have to finish this. I don't like rushing through stuff, but I prefer explaining stuff more clearly. Okay, good. So before I start, let me first acknowledge my awesome collaborators. So Michael Knapp, Frank Pullmans, who are professors in TU Munich, and Kirish Dengel, who's a professor in California Riverside, and Adam Smith, who was postdoc in our group and now a professor at Nottingham. And this we primarily based on these two works. So this guy should, if you're interested, this guy should appear on Monday, and you can read about it if you want. Okay, great. So let's get started. So in nature, we know that matter occurs in different phases, which is a result of, you know, microscopic interactions of many different particles. And now this has led to a very rich variety of phenomena, such as signature breaking, universal scaling, and topological invariance, et cetera, which has been sort of like the central theme in the study of condensed matter. But however, there's a few significant challenge, despite the fact that we have gained more and more better and better theoretical understanding of these phases, which is centralized on these two keywords, which the first one is the realization. Let me minimize my window. The first one is the realization of these exotic phases, and the second one is the detection of such exotic phases. And among all the different phases, quantum phases, class of phases, one of the most exotic one should be the topological phases, which is the phases of matter that remain disordered even at zero temperature. So topological phases, sometimes referred to as spin liquid states, they are exotic matter that have a long range pattern that cannot be detected by any local measurements. And the first experimental discovery of such systems is the fractional quantum Hall effect, dated back to 1982. After that, people have been very excited and tried to find various in actual materials to find systems that have topological order. And there has been a lot of proposals for various candidates for these quantum spin liquid states. However, almost all of them, more or less, they have their own issue, and it's really difficult to confirm the existence of topological order in an unambiguous way. And in fact, up until now, perhaps the only unambiguous solid state system that has a topological order is still the fractional quantum Hall effects. Fractional quantum Hall effects. But despite the challenge in the experimental realization and detection, you know, it doesn't stop us from gaining theoretical understanding. And then one really nice strategy for doing so is to study so-called trial states. So these states, they are extremely simplified version of the realistic systems, but they capture the relevant physics such that we can understand most of the physics just by looking at them without worrying about the physical details. And it has gained tremendous success, starting from the seminal work of Anderson in RVB states, and also followed by Laughlin, for example, how we can understand fractional quantum Hall effect. Now, as the technology has grown rapidly recently, we have gained more and more control in these quantum simulators. And this provides a new avenue for us to actually realize these topological states. And we can actually detect them because we have more flexibility and controllability on this platform than in those material systems. So just to list a few works that were along these directions, this work actually was done between us and Google. We realized the toroidal ground states on superconducting qubits. At the same time, the Harvard group also put out work that's realizing the same topological order, but on Rydberg simulators. And more recently, the Quantinuum actually used measurements to realize non-Abelian topological ground states on the trapped ions simulators. And just to list a few, there are also others which I'm not listing here. Now, what's so fun about these things? So these states that I listed here, these examples and others, these are mostly the states that we have already understood pretty well. So they are the trial model states. But always that by probing these states with a controllable quantum platforms, we can, you know, start to know how to realize them, and we can get more and more experience, and eventually we can utilize them by as a resource, or using the experience we learn in realization of them to actually solve the problem that we could not solve before without the quantum simulators. So these are a good starting point for us to actually explore the power of quantum simulations. Now, the examples I mentioned again, they also focus mostly on very specific topological states. And in fact, they're very special. They are actually the fixed point states in topological phases, and they're easy to realize. But you can ask naturally, what happens when we step away from these fixed points, right? So can we actually, even better, have a phase transition between states that have a distinct topological order? And this is extremely challenging and has not been fully addressed. So today's talk will be trying to, at least the first part of talk, will be trying to, will be our attempt, our new strategy to actually deal with this or address this problem. And our strategy will rely on the new concept of so-called the isometric tensor networks. So this is the overview of the talk. As I mentioned before, the first part will be the realization of phase transitions. And the second part will be a comment on briefly mentioning the work on quantum machine learning that's relevant for the application. Good. Are there any questions so far? Good. Okay. So let's get started. So tensor network state. So what is tensor network state? So tensor network state actually, as we know, that when we increase number of particles in a quantum systems, the Hilbert space dimension actually grows exponentially. So this poses a significant challenge if you want to simulate the systems on the classical computers, which is impossible as you just basically have more and more particles. But there's a very clever way or powerful technique that we can actually sometimes circumvent this difficulty. And this technique is called tensor networks. So in one dimension, this is called matrix product states, or short as MPS. So MPS is essentially a clever parameterization of the quantum states such that we can focus on the relevant part of the Hilbert space and throw away the irrelevant part of the Hilbert space in a very strategic way, such that we don't lose information. So this is how it works. So suppose we have the coefficients of the wave function, which, you know, basically are labeled by all the physical lags. And then now what we can do is we can do a sequence of singular value decompositions of these large tensors. Then we can actually get it to a form like this, where this graphical notation means that we have these tensors at each local site, and these lag connecting them will be the contraction between the lags of the tensors. Now, we have written down a wave function in terms of this tensor contraction. This is essentially the matrix product states. And this guy B in the bulk, they are simply just D times chi tensors, where D is the dimension of the physical lag representing the physical degrees of freedom, and chi, they are the what we call bond dimension, which is the dimension of this virtual lag that is contracted. And now it turns out that there is a generic property for one-dimensional quantum gapped local quantum systems, such that the ground states satisfy so-called the area law entanglement. And then this area law entanglement implies that we can, in fact, we don't need large bond dimension to actually get a good description of physical ground states, but rather we can get very good approximation of all the relevant physical quantities by just setting this chi to be a constant that's independent of system size. So it can describe physical ground states efficiently with just constant chi. Okay, so why do I bring up tensor networks, and how does it help with our problem of realization of quantum phase transitions? And in fact, there's a very nice discovery that was made by Wolf and Ignatius Zirag in 2006, that in fact, matrix product state, or MPS, can describe exact quantum phase transition despite being very fine-tuned. So let me show this very simple examples where you have a phase diagram that has a system that has three terms. One is the ferromagnetic term, the other one is the cluster term, the third one is the transverse field term. And the relative strength of these three terms can be actually tuned freely, such that you can get to a symmetry breaking phase and symmetry protected topological phase, or SPD phase, or a trivial phase. Now, in fact, if you tune these parameters in a very fine-tuned way, such that you go along this path, it has been shown that the ground states of the Hamiltonian along this black path can actually be exactly described by a matrix Planck states with a bond dimension 2. And then the MPS is shown here. Sorry for the notation. I should use B here instead of M. And then now you can see that there's a parameter in this matrix Planck state. And when G is minus 1, we actually at this point, which is the plus the state point that has the non-trivial SPD. And when G is plus 1, we're at this point. And when G goes to minus 1 to plus 1, we simply go through a quantum phase transition at the tricritical point, and then we transit from one phase to the other phase. And why is MPS nice for realization is that it tends there's an exact correspondence between sequentially generated quantum circuits of this structure and matrix Planck states. The statement is the following. So if you have an MPS in one dimension or finite bond dimension, you can always turn it into a quantum circuit of this type, and vice versa. If you have a quantum circuit of this architecture, you can always turn it into an MPS. So these two are more or less equivalent. And by using this equivalence, you can actually realize this path of ground states along this entire phase diagram, and then you can even measure their signatures of phase transitions on a real device. And this has been done actually 4 or 5 years ago. Now, I just show you one-dimensional tensor networks, but our goal is more ambitious. We want to go for two-dimensional, which can actually host intrinsic topologic order that was not possible in 1D. And there's also a similar notion of tensor network in 2D. I would just refer to as TensorNet TNS, or sometimes perhaps projected entanglement pair states. I'll use these two interchangeably. They mean the same thing. And then the tensor network is a simple generalization of 1D tensor network. So for example, suppose we have a system that's defined on a square lattice. Now each spin degrees of freedom sits on the edges of this square lattice. Now we can define the local tensor to look like this, where these four virtual legs will be contracted out when we construct wave functions. And there are two physical legs that sit on these two edges. Now the reason why we only have four of them, because if you have translation invariance, this will simply be the unit cell of the tensors. And then when we contract this guy, we simply get a wave function representation for the systems. And the tensor now we have dimension will simply be larger than the 1D MPS. We have a dimension d squared times d times d times d. Now I call this capital D the bond dimension of the 2D TNS. And the d, again, will be the physical dimension and d squared because we have two physical legs. Okay.
No,
now, yes.
So in the 1D case, what's the physics of the tricritical point?
What's the what? Sorry?
Field theory.
What's the field theory describing this?
The tricritical point.
Oh, the tricritical point. So it has dynamical critical exponents of 2. It's not really a CFT. So if you look at the ground states, it's like a G at Z state that's all 0 plus or 1. So it's a very fine-tuned non-CFT critical point. So if you want to write down a field theory, it's going to be a very stupid field theory. So it's not interesting. Yeah.
But generally, I can access this critical point by tuning two parameters.
You mean other critical points?
No, just the tricritical point.
By tuning one parameter, yes. And these three parameters, these three couplings would depend on this single parameter G. Yeah. Cool. Any other questions? Okay. And so, as I explained before, 1D MPS is not powerful enough for topological phases with intrinsic topological order. But in fact, in two dimensions, we can indeed have such things. And in fact, we recently also showed that you can actually construct exact quantum phase transition, even have a very rich phase diagram that's containing so-called symmetry-enriched topological phases. So using just two-dimensional tensor networks. So once symmetry in rich topological phases, so now suppose we have an intrinsic topological, the intrinsically topologically ordered phase, such as the familiar toric curve phase, right? So what do you mean by the intrinsically topological order is that it has some anions, excitations, as excitations on top of ground states. Now, an SET phase means that an SET phase is a phase that emerges when you have a physical symmetry in addition to the existence of the intrinsic topological order, right? And then what does this SET mean is that suppose you have excitations on top of this intrinsic topological order ground states, and when you apply the physical symmetry to the states, it will do a transformation, it perform a transformation on the states. And when an SET order exists, this physical symmetry transformation can be written as a product of these local operators that's localized around each excitations in your ground state. And the form of these localized operators will actually characterize the different SET phases. Essentially, this phenomena is called the so-called symmetry fractionalizations. So this is similar to how symmetry actually fractionalizes in one-dimensional SPT states, but on the edges in one dimension. But in two dimension, on SET, it just fractionalizes on the anions instead. Okay, so with a tensor network, we can actually do better than 1D is that with a tensor network with a constant bond dimension, we can already create a phase diagram that has an extended region of phases and with encoding quantum phase transition between them. So you can see that there is an SET phase with a toric code order, that's a Z2 spin, Z2 topological order, and the SET is simply a time reversal symmetry. And you can have a toric code that does not have an SET, you can have a trivial states that's adiabatic connected to the product states, and you can have different transition between them. And now it's the ground states here would actually contain a CFT, 2 plus 0 dimensional CFT. Now, but what's really different from the story in the 2D than in the 1D system is that despite the fact that we have a tensor network description of the ground state across the entire phase diagram, but the correspondence between the tensor network and sequential quantum circuit is actually no longer true in two dimension. In 1D, it's always true, but in 2D, it's not always true. So even though we have this phase diagram, but there's no way that we can efficiently realize them on an actual device. So in order to, so that that brings us to our recent work, we try to address this problem by basically imposing certain mathematical properties on the tensor networks. Good. Yes.
When you say it's described by a 2 plus 0 dimensional theory, what is described by 2 plus 0 dimensional theory?
The ground state properties, so if you are on this phase boundary, if you measure the correlation of certain operators on these ground states, the equal time correlation on the ground state, then they will be described by 2 plus 0 dCFD, the scaling of them.
And I cannot ask any question about dynamics.
Yes, the dynamics would not be universal. It would be something weird. Yeah. So these are very fine-tuned. It's a tensor network. That all the ground states will be exactly tensor network with bond dimension 3. So they are not like transition that's driven by Hamiltonian, where you can actually have 2 plus 1 dCFT. Here is a tensor network driven Hamiltonian, tensor network driven phase transition. So this will be highly fine-tuned in some sense. Yeah. Good. Any other questions? Great. So now how do we get around with this? That the fact that we don't have a quantum circuit correspondence in 2D similar to 1D, and now we want to really dig into this and try to impose further conditions which allow us to construct efficiently realizable path of quantum of two-dimensional topological quantum phase transitions using tensor networks. And the strategy we use is the following. We impose two conditions to actually allow this to work. So the first condition we call the plumbing condition. So this plumbing condition, the purpose of this plumbing condition is to enable us to actually encode classical partition function in a tensor network states. So let me make this statement more precise. So suppose we start again with our two-dimensional tensor network we had before. Now we assume this tensor network can be decomposed into the following form, where this is another tensor we call W matrix. I will explain why it's a matrix later. You can just think of like these are the rows and these are the columns. And then these are so-called plumbing delta, where plumbing delta is a tensor which takes value one if all the three legs are equal. It takes value zero otherwise. Okay. So the fact that we require the tensor to be equal, to be able to be decomposed into this form, it means that we have turned the physical, the virtual degrees of freedom into the physical degrees of freedom. So they are actually equivalent. So what's the consequence of this? The consequence of this is that, in fact, you can show these tensors, the wave function that's generated by this tensor network, when you construct them, they actually correspond to exact classical partition function for some two-dimensional systems. And one convenient way to see this is to by defining so-called wave matrix. And this wave matrix now encoding the square norm of the matrix elements in this W matrix. And they actually, because now the virtual legs, we have the same, play the same role as the physical legs. So we can think of these I, J, M, and N, which label the four virtual legs, to be the physical spin configuration that's around this vertex. Now, the R matrix would then tell you about what's the probability for a given a spin configuration I, J, M, N around this vertex. And you now the R matrix can then be used to construct, for example, if you want to construct norm of the wave function, this is similarly as contracting the classical partition function whose transfer operator is actually built from the product of this R. So for people who are interested in R is also the matrix that's satisfying so-called Young-Baxter equation when you have exactly solvable models, which actually in this case, I will mention later, in our case, the model is exactly solvable. Okay, so this is the message that I want to say, that by this condition, it just leads to such equivalence that the square norm of wave function coefficients for each spin configurations is exactly equal to some classical Boltzmann weights in some classical partition functions in two dimensions. And this is not new, of course. This correspondence in a different language was already used by Laughlin, called plasma analogy, and also by Verstrata in the tensor network language before. Now, this is the first condition. We have turned the problem of a quantum problem, basically simplify it into a classical problem so that we can better understand, as you will see later. Now, the second condition we want to impose is so-called the isometric condition. So this condition is graphically represented as follow. So again, we have the tensor we have from before. And what we do now is take the complex conjugation that's basically indicated by this flipped physical legs, and we contract the complex conjugation with itself. And now this contraction should lead to two delta tensors. Again, the delta tensor means that it takes value one if both legs are equal, and it takes value zero if both legs it takes like value zero otherwise. And now the tensors that actually satisfy this is in fact called the isometric tensor networks. Now, the point of isometric tensor network is that it establishes something that's analogous to the canonical form of MPS, which is the reason why there's a quantum circuits correspondent between MPS and quantum circuits. So now after we impose this isometric condition, the tensor network that we're using also have this form, and therefore it can be written, can be mapped into a linear depth sequentially generated quantum circuits, as I will show later. So here's a reminder how the state is constructed, that I did not do anything other than just imposing two mathematical conditions on these local tensors. And you can see the wave function is still a tensor contraction of all the local tensors. Now, these errors that I indicate here were just to tell the direction of the contraction because you can actually define it to be differently. Okay. Good. Now, what's the consequence of these two conditions? So recall the first condition is this plumbing condition, that I can turn this classical, this wave quantum wave function in two dimensions into associate them to some two-dimensional classical wave functions. And the second condition is the ISO-TNS condition. Now, if you look at these two mathematical conditions together, it actually can be combined into one single mathematical condition, which essentially is a condition on the W matrix that you that have been written here. Essentially says that the if you viewed ij as the row and mn as the column, then essentially says that the square norm of each column vector in this W matrix has to be exactly normalized. So as long as this is satisfied, then these two conditions are actually, the ISO-TNS condition is satisfied, and also trivially by definition satisfy the first condition. Now let's look at an example. So why is this helpful? And how does this help us with identification of interesting set of quantum states we can realize? So let's look at a so-called torical ground states. I'm not going to a definition, which I just mentioned here what it is. So torical ground states are, you know, Z2 topological ground state that in fact can be thought of as equal weighted superposition of closed loop configurations, where these loops are formed by a string of one states and the vacuum is simply all zero states, okay? Now, if you look at W matrix of this form, in fact, you can show the wave function you constructed out of this is exactly a torical model. Here, I'm just visualizing all the possible elements in this W matrix, and each element is labeled by for I, J, M, and N, and you just put them into this tensor diagram here. You can see they correspond to eight different configurations of strings, eight different configurations around each vertex, where these red guys are labeling state one, and these gray guys are labeling state zero. And you can see these eight configurations simply impose a no broken string conditions. All the eight configurations have only closed string. And then if you look at this W matrix and turn it into the weight matrix, it in fact maps to so-called the eight vertex model in classical statistics. Statistical mechanics, and this eight vertex means that there's all eight possible configurations that you can have at each eight vertex around each vertex. Okay. Good. Are there any questions so far? Good. Now we can consider, in order to find a path, now let's consider a W matrix which is deformed away from this exact torical limit, and then consider this path where this now W matrix has a parameter g, which we can tune from -1 to +1. Now, when g is +1, you can easily check that this is exactly the W matrix that generates the torical ground states before. Now, when g is -1, you can check that this is almost torical, except that here there's a -1 on this entry. But if you visualize the wave function, what this means is that whenever you have this particular vertex configuration, you just associate a minus sign to the coefficients of that configuration. And therefore, in fact, the torical ground states and the ground states at -1 are related to each other by a finite depth quantum circuits, finite depth unitary transformations. And therefore, the two actually have the same intrinsic topological order, which cannot be changed by any finite depth local unitary transformations. But what's interesting about this path when g tuned through -1 to +1 is that this path has actually a Z2 physical symmetry that's generated by a Pauli x that acts on all the degrees of freedom. And then this Z2 symmetry, which is a symmetry in addition to the intrinsic topological order, can actually separate disconnected two phases and have distinct SET phases. And then, in fact, if you look at how the symmetry SET phase can be classified with a Z2 gauge group for Z2 topological order and Z2 physical symmetry, they're in fact two distinct SET phases in this case. And I'm going to show what I'm going to argue below is, in fact, when G is smaller than zero, this state you generated with this W matrix belongs to an SET phase where the symmetry fractionalizes non-trivially in a non-trivial fashion over the anions of the torical, and when g is greater than zero, it belongs to the same phase as the conventional torical, which is the one that we are familiar with. Now, a very strict yes. Sorry.
If g is smaller than -1 or larger than one, what happens?
I don't know. I I did not investigate that, but I would not, I don't think that would change too much anyway. So the only phase transition you can actually, so you, if you map this to eight vertex model, you can see that only phase transition happens when g is equal to zero. So there's no other phase transition that could happen. So all the ground states should be adiabatically connected for g is smaller than zero and g is greater than zero. So the only critical point should only be a g is equal to zero for all g.
There's another comment. Maybe this is not relevant to your work, but the classification of Z2 topological order with the unitary Z2 symmetry is not given by the expression you have. If we assume that anions are not permuted by the symmetry, then it's H of Z2 comma Z2 cross Z2, and the classification not is Z2 cross Z2. I guess here you are also assuming only one of the E and the M can carry some fractionalization.
Exactly. So I did not want to include this comment because it's too technical. That's exactly correct. So this is only partial classification. I'm not including other case like permuting. I'm not allowing permutation of anions and all that. I'm also using this. This is the classification that's given by Chern-Simons theory. That's described by Chern-Simons theory, basically. Then this is a precise Chern-Simons theory without permuting anions. Then this is the classification. Yeah. Good. Any other questions? Okay. So a straightforward way to see actually the system belongs to distinct SCT phases for G smaller than zero and G greater than zero is actually to look at something similar to a bulk boundary correspondence. That is, if we apply the symmetry of the system to the bulk, and in fact, the operation, this bulk operation can be mapped to an effective operation on the boundary of the system when you define a system on a cylinder. And in a tensor network state, this boundary operation can be worked out exactly in terms of so-called matrix product operators, MPO, which I would not discuss too much here. But what you should know is that when I do this, I can actually map out this effective operator. Then I can compute a topological invariant from this effective operator. In this Z2 case, it's very simple. I only have to square this guy, and what I get is simply an operator which is identity with a sign that depends only on the sign of G. Okay, so to the power of P, and this P is actually a quantum number which labels distinct anions in the toric code that I have. For example, when in my convention, when P is zero, we have the trivial particle in the toric code. When P is one, represents, say, the electric charge in the toric code. And you can see that when G is minus one, when G is smaller than zero, and V squared will give you plus one and minus one in a two different sectors. But when G is greater than zero, you see that for both P equal to zero and P equal to one, you get one and one. And in fact, these two set of data, they label the distinct elements in this second cohomology group here. And therefore, we can deduce that when G is greater than or smaller than zero, they belong to distinct SCT phases, and the phase transition happened exactly at a point of G is equal to zero. And of course, what I discussed was with mathematical, and there's a more physical way to confirm this statement is simply by measure some kind of membrane order parameter, which is simply applying the symmetry operator partially on the systems, so and insert the appropriate boundary operators on the cylinder. And in this simply is a general, for those who know, this is a simple generalization of so-called string order parameters for one-dimensional SPT phases. And now if you do this, you will see that when G is smaller than zero, this guy is completely zero. And when G is greater than zero, there's a non-zero expectation value of the membrane order parameter. And the explanation of this is simply due to a superselection rule that was well understood in the context of SPT. That is, when a symmetry fractionalization happens on the boundary of your systems, the membrane order parameter will actually be guaranteed to be zero due to this fractionalization, due to a superselection rule arising due to this fractionalization. Okay, so we can see a phase transition here. Now, some people might argue, okay, now we have this state, but what about the Hamiltonian? And of course, across all the G, because we are essentially dealing with a two-dimensional tensor network state, it's guaranteed that we always have a parent Hamiltonian, which is frustration-free. and each term in Hamiltonian is local and always stays as a projector. And if you drive it, it looks like the following. It consists of two set of terms which act on this vertex degrees of freedom and also this Laplace degrees of freedom. And as you tune G, you can check the spectrum of the Hamiltonian by doing small size exact diagonalization. And here is an example on 16 qubits. And you can see that away from G equals zero, the gap, the system is actually gap as we expect, and the gap closes as we approach G is equal to zero, and closes exactly in this case with a gapless spectrum above the ground state energy. Good. Now I've told you about all about what happens when you have when you're away from G is zero. But what happens when G is equal to zero? Okay. So this part is really fun. So when G is equal to zero, as we scroll back a little bit, and you can see that what happens is that these six elements will stay non-zero, but these two elements would be would vanish. And what this implies, if you look at the classical mapping that we described before, it essentially tells you that the eight vertex model that we have before is becoming is reduced to six vertex model, which is another exactly solvable classical model. And even better, at G is equal to zero, the six vertex corresponding six vertex model is essentially is actually gapless, which you can show by beta ansatz. And when a system is gapless, the boundary condition becomes really important because the correlation length in principle can be infinitely long. Now, to understand this critical point, it's more convenient to rotate the lattice that we had before by 45 degrees anti-clockwise. And then when you rotate the lattice, you can observe actually there's a conservation law, which I state here and I'll explain below. That is, the lines of state one formed by the state one are actually conserved number of lines formed by state one actually conserve across any horizontal slice unless they are terminating on the boundary. So how do we understand this? So first thing we can do is we can take the matrix element of the W matrix and square it, and we look at what these matrix elements the spin configuration corresponding to these matrix elements with 45 degree rotations. Now you can see that these non-zero matrix elements, they have special interpretation, right? So if you look at these lines, you imagine you trace this line from the bottom to the top, then these lines will always go through the vertex without turning back, okay? And the number of lines below this vertex is always the same as the number of lines above this vertex. So the flux, which is formed by these red lines, are always conserved. Now, if we translate it to the ground states, what happens is the following. Now, suppose we initialize the tensor network states with some boundary states, and we want to obtain wave function by contracting the tensor networks. Now, as we contract the tensor networks, what happens is that these red lines, they start from the boundary, and then they are tracing out like this, but they can never turn back. The only thing they can do is they either cross each other or they terminate on the boundary that's opposite to the bottom one, okay? And what's really interesting about this, if some people might have already realized this, is that this is essentially like is similar to well lines of classical particles. Now, if you think of these boundaries as some initial position where some one-dimensional classical particles sit, now as time progresses, which is along this T direction that I label here, the particles can jump according to some stochastic rules determined by these matrix elements. So for example, particles can turn right and turn left with the same probability, or particles can turn left and turn right with the same probability. Or if two particles meet each other at certain vertex, they are bound, they're bouncing away from each other with certainty. So with these classical pictures, the upshot is that the wave function results from this tensor network contraction at G is equal to zero is a superposition of well lines of one-dimensional classical particles moving, emanating from the bottom boundary, and it would end at the top boundary, okay? Does that make sense? Good. Now, I've told you this classical pictures, right? So how do we use this classical picture to actually understand the properties on the ground states? And one very nice thing we know of these particles, if you think of, suppose you only have one particles, and what this particle is doing is just jump like this, like this, like this. So this is essentially a random walk without any preferences. Now it becomes interacting when you have more than one particles, but when the interaction is small enough, they still resemble independent random walk. So if you measure the correlation along the time direction, you actually would expect some kind of diffusive behavior because of the random walk. So therefore, this translated wave function, it means that the spin-spin correlation in the wave function along this spatial direction should actually be power law. And we can confirm this by simple calculation using the tensor networks. For example, here I compute the spin-spin correlations in the bulk with an with the boundary conditions that look like this. So this plus means that it's a 0 plus 1 state. And then if you expand this, this is simply an equal weight superposition of all the possible classical initial conditions. And the spin-spin correlation in this case would be the typical correlations that you will have on these all the possible classical problems that I just described. And indeed, we see a diffusive behavior, which is 1/√R here. Cool. Now, I just described to you that the properties away from G is zero and G is exactly equal to zero. And of course, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the talk, that not only we can understand this microscopic picture using tensor networks, but this path of ground states that interpolate between distinct topologically ordered phases can be realized efficiently using a sequential quantum circuit due to the isometric condition that I imposed. So the quantum circuit looks very simple. That is, we start with a state which is the product states between all the zero states in the bulk and certain boundary states, which can be basically any states you like. And then we define a gate, which is a 4-qubit gate. You can decompose some into 2-qubit gates and 1 3-qubit gate. It's very simple. Now with this definition, then a quantum circuit is simply the following. You start from the bottom, and then you just apply this gate sequentially along diagonal. And then this red region will shade the spread of the entanglement. And as you go along the entire diagonal, you finish the preparation of the state. You actually get a state that's described by the tensor networks in the last few slides. And then this parameter, these gates would depend on some parameter G, which is the same parameter G that I used in the previous slides. As you tune them, you can go through a quantum phase transitions in the ground states of the system. Okay, so this will be the first part of my talk. So in summary, I show you that we propose a plumbing procedure to how to encode a classical partition function of isoTNS, and we can search within this restricted manifold the interesting path that we can realize efficiently for two-dimensional topological quantum phase transitions. And this is also point two. And now the very interesting thing that the problem that we solve is that it was proven before that the typical correlations in these tensor network states, in these isometric tensor network states, is exponentially decaying, which is not surprising because the same generic features are also there for generic two-dimensional tensor networks. But it was an open question whether isoTNS can support power law correlations. In this work, we show this is indeed possible by giving a concrete example. So this problem is basically, And apart from this, a significant of this thing is we can indeed do this on a quantum computer. You can see this circuit is not too complicated, and then it's possible that we can do this in the near future. Good. So this concludes the first part of my talk. Then I'll very quickly mention the second part of my talk. Probably have 10 minutes or so. Something like this.
Can I ask some questions?
Yes.
So is the sixth vertex model solvable?
Yes. It's exactly solvable, meaning that the spectrum of your transfer operator for the partition function can be exactly solved.
Then why do you need to map it into random walk?
Because even though the eigenvalues can be exactly solved, it's not necessarily easy to compute correlation functions. This is because this is the same problem for beta ansatz. In fact, you can solve six vertex model using beta ansatz. But as you know, for beta ansatz, solving eigenvalues does not directly give you correlation functions. And computing correlation function can be much more difficult. than just solving the spectrum.
Let's see. Another question. You mentioned this symmetry fractionalization implies some membrane orbit is zero. Why is that?
So this is I do not want to go into details because this was actually some result known from SBT. So you can what happens is that if you apply this main, so maybe it's best to explain the SBT case, then the same holds in the SET phase in this picture. Okay, so in the SBT phase, what happens is that you have a symmetry, and if you can have string operators, right? And in the string operators, what happens is that it consists of symmetry in the bulk and some boundary operators at the end of the string operators. Now, when you apply to the systems, the symmetry on the partial symmetry in the bulk of the string operator would actually fraction. They basically get absorbed into physical degrees of freedom, and they fractionalize into some non-trivial operators on the boundary. Now, this fractionalized operators, they talk to the boundary operators to insert in these string operators or membrane operators, and they have certain algebraic rules which you can prove directly that it has to be zero when it corresponds to some non-trivial elements in a second cohomology group. So it's some mathematical result. I don't know what's the physical intuition behind this, but you can prove it basically because of these two boundary operators. They anti-commute, for example, in the Z2 cross Z2 case. Then they are exactly zero. Are there any other questions before we move on?
Oh, by the way, does this tensor network have time reversal symmetry?
Yes, it has a time reversal symmetry, which is this spin flip composed with complex conjugation.
I see. Then in that case, it's correct to say the classification of symmetry fractionalization Z2, because the other one is anomalous.
You can also say it's actually a time reversal symmetric SET. That's also fine, I think.
But I'm saying, knowing there's another time reversal symmetry enforces that it's impossible for both E and M to have fractional quantum number under the unitary Z2.
Yes. Yeah, correct. Good. Okay, so let's move on to the second part of my talk. Doing this quickly, about 10 minutes, that's enough. So I have told you about how we can realize, I mentioned at the beginning that we can realize specific quantum topologically ordered quantum states. But now I've also mentioned our recent results on how the possibility of realization of quantum phase transitions, right? Now, with these realizations, of course, there's no new physics yet that we can understand with them. But what are the cool applications we can do? We can use them, or what are the possibility, possible new physics in the future we can learn from them? And then this is through the combining with so-called quantum machine learning for the task of recognizing quantum phases, which I'm going to talk about now. Of course, I'm not going to talk about two-dimensional case, but I'm just motivate the potential application of these two-dimensional states as resource using the one-dimensional example here. So the task we want to solve, one interesting task what we potentially want to solve is the following. Suppose in the future you have some powerful quantum computers in some way, and you can use quantum computers to solve for the many-body ground states of the complex quantum systems. Now, if you are given the ground states, you can ask what phases do this ground state belong to, okay? So the traditional way of doing this, because now you're not on the classical computers, you cannot access the wave function directly. So the traditional way of doing this in experiments is to measure certain order parameters, right? So like Z2, then some order, local order parameters. If it's topological, then potentially some non-local order parameters. But then in general, except for some very simple toy models, the choice of the order parameters is very difficult. It's difficult to choose the correct order parameters to measure. And secondly, even if you know which one to measure, it's not necessarily easy to do them experimentally. So one interesting task is can we use quantum machine learning to automate the discovery of order parameters correct all the parameters for these phases, and they're also efficiently measurable in the experiments. Now, in order to do this, we can sort of jump back to theory and ask ourselves, how do we do phase classification on a theoretical level? And the answer was addressed about 10 years ago by a group of people, including Frank Xie Chen and Norbert Xu and Ross Strada here, actually these two references. And the classification relies on very simple equivalence relation in here, which is so-called a local unitary transformation. The statement is the following. Given any ground state psi, it belongs to phase A if it connects to the fixed point of the phase by the finite depth local unitary circuits that respect necessary symmetry of the system. Where the fixed point here, I mean, is the real space RG fixed point. Okay, it has zero correlation length and has all the characteristic of the phase. Now, then with this equivalence relation, given any ground states, then you can perform a real space RG flow, or you can apply finite depth local unitary circuits, and you can see which fixed point does it map to. Then with this, you can classify all the phases of matter, and this indeed is how one-dimensional quantum phases have been classified. And from this theoretical analysis, we can know what's the essential and minimal information for phase classification is the fixed point wave function for each phase and actually the symmetry group of the phases that we're interested in. Now, how do we use these minimal information? Then this implies that these are also the minimal information we need for the quantum machine learning task to actually work, okay? So in order to go into the quantum machine learning task, we need to choose an ansatz that we want to optimize over, apply the quantum machine learning algorithm to. A natural ansatz is so-called a quantum convolutional neural network, which was introduced as an ansatz to recognize phases of matter because it's analogy to RG structure. So you can see the circuit consists of three components. So the first component is called convolutional, which is a finite depth unitary circuits. And the second component is called a pooling layer. So this pooling layer, what it does is it will apply control unitary and then to extract only a subset of qubit in to enter the next level. And once you enter the next level, the rest of the qubits or spins are not touched anymore. And then you repeat the same structure over and over again until you hit the final layer. And the final layer is just a global unitary that acts on all the qubits on the final layer. And this is called fully connected. Now, this quantum convolutional neural net has several interesting features. One particular one is if you optimize the neural net, the QZNN using gradient-based approach actually has not have any bound plateau. So meaning that it can potentially be much easier than other ansatz to be optimized. But however, since it's proposed, it still is extremely challenging to train this neural network to learn something that we don't know about. And the reason is mainly comes from twofold. One is that it's very difficult to obtain the source of data we need to train this QZNN because we have to solve the ground states and put them, you know, give this to QZNN. And solving ground state on quantum computers now is extremely difficult, and we have to give a lot of data for it to train. And secondly, there's risk of overfitting, right? So suppose you have some specific physical models and you solve the ground states of this model and give it to the QZNN, but maybe this model has some very convenient feature, and the QZNN you train entirely based on this model will pick up these convenient feature and will become very overfitted and vulnerable to noise. In order to avoid this, we propose a very simple procedure, which consists of three steps. So the first step is that we prepare a fixed point state for the phase, which is usually very simple on a quantum computer because the absence of correlation. And the second step we do is apply local symmetric unitary gates, which are random in their parameters. So these gates are symmetric, local, or randomly chosen, and they generate some finite correlation length in your fixed point state. And the third thing is that we feed these randomly generated states to the training, supervised training of the QZNN. A schematic diagram is simply shown here that we have fixed point prepared of some known phases we know. Then we apply these symmetric unitary gates, which are randomly chosen, such that generate some finite correlation length. And then we apply the QZNN. And at the end, we measure two outputs, for example. And then suppose we're interested in three distinct phases, say the symmetry breaking, the paramagnetic, and symmetry protected topological phases, then we can use three of the bit strings to represent the probability for the prediction for each phase. And there's an additional one which we can throw away or classify as fail. Okay. Now, a very subtle point, which I'm not going into too many details here, is that there's actually a no-go theorem you can prove if these local unitary noise, they don't have a translational invariance or any additional symmetries. So you can prove that if they don't have these additional symmetries, the unitary will be sufficiently random such that the solution of the QZNN can actually never exist. So this is a no-go theorem. So in order to do this, we have to actually impose a translation invariance in the local symmetric unitary noise that we add to the fixed points. So what's the advantage of this protocol? The advantage, as I mentioned before, first, this training protocol, as you see, only depends on the fixed point that we choose and is independent of any Hamiltonian or any physical models of interest. And the second is that the fixed points are easy to prepare on a digital quantum computer, as I mentioned before. And the third is that the key is that the random unitary gates, they have two advantages. One is when you're training, you can start from the easy case of zero layer of symmetric local unitary noise, such that the correlation length is very small. Then it's easy for the QZNN to converge. Then as you increase the number of layers of this local unitary noise, the correlation length would on average also increase. Then the difficulty of the training can be gradually tuned up such that a convergence becomes much more stable. And secondly, as you generate more and more correlation length, some microscopic details that's originally encoded in the fixed point you choose will be washed away because of these correlations. So the physics you learn, and the QZNN would learn, will be the universal physics that characterizes the phases that have particular symmetries. Good. So I've told you about this method, and of course we can test it on some real physical models. And note that we train the no physical models was known to the QZNN. You only train on based on fixed points and symmetries, which I'll point out what are they later. So to show this, I'm going to show a time reversal system in one dimension, which is the same model that I showed before, the triangular phase diagram, so-called the cluster Ising model. And there are three distinct phases, as I mentioned, as you tune these three parameters. Okay, so the phase diagram here is the same as you saw, the left-hand side, the same one you saw before. There are three distinct phases, and the background colors, they are the prediction of the, so they are the theoretical phase diagram, the background colors, and the circle with colors, they are the prediction of the QZNN. So if the background color matches with the colors of the circle, then the QZNN makes a correct prediction. Otherwise, it makes the wrong prediction, okay? And during the training, we only feed these three points, which turns out to be the fixed points of these three distinct phases to the QZNN, and we perturb them, we feed the data, generate data with symmetric perturbations. And this QZNN has size 4 qubit. And as you can see, this is not ideal. That is, when you're close to the phase boundary, the QZNN becomes less accurate as we expect because the correlation length is long. But when we move deeply into the phase, the QZNN is doing a reasonable job, okay? But this model is, in fact, you can show this is free fermion model. Now we can add a perturbation which make this model non-free fermion, that's genuinely interacting. And then the feature still persists, meaning that the prediction by the QZNN is not fine-tuned to non-interacting models. And of course, as I mentioned before, the 4-qubit QZNN is too small to accommodate long correlations. You can increase the size of the QZNN, and you can see the improvement when we increase from 4-qubit QZNN to 8-qubit, that the prediction of the QZNN becomes extremely accurate around phase boundary. And now the QZNN predicted phase diagram matches almost perfectly with the theoretical phase diagram. And similarly for the perturbed cluster Ising model, and you can also predict the curvature of this phase diagram. Now to see this more clearly, we can walk along this path and plot different probabilities the probabilities for each phase predicted by the KZNN. You can see that these lines, they are the KZNN prediction. The background, again, they are the theoretical phase diagram. And you can see when the top probabilities crosses each other, they correspond exactly to the location of the phase boundary. And what I just show you, of course, it's only one dimensional example. You can ask, you know, in 1D, I understand everything. There's no new physics there, right? And of course, we can apply, there's no reason that we cannot apply the same algorithm, the same procedure we proposed to two-dimensional models. And this is a work in progress. I'm gonna not go into too many details here, but basically you can have a phase diagram. Suppose we want to target a phase diagram that's similar to the Z2 gauge model. You have a toric cone with Z2 topological order here. When we turn on two fields, it can enter some kind of confining phase and some kind of Higgs phase. Now, what we did is that we start from the fixed points of topological order, and then another fixed point, which is, say, the product state, which is the infinite field limit. I should put this red dot far away. And then with these two, it doesn't know about any physical models. Now, what we do is apply generic random unitary with translation variance, and then use them as data to train the QZNN. And we make use the QZNN to make prediction on the ground states around this phase diagram. And you can see that the structure of the phase diagram is already well produced by this very naive training. Even though we use a point that's product state along this axis, the EM duality, which is the symmetry along this line, is roughly emerged, actually roughly emerged back again in the prediction of the QZNN. So there's a hope that, in fact, this also works pretty well in two dimension, even for exotic phases like intrinsically topological ones. Good. Now, by this, I'd like to conclude my presentation. So in the second part, I told you how we can efficiently train quantum circuit classifiers using only reference state, which is the fixed point state. And by adding symmetric perturbation to the data, we can force the QZN to learn the universal features of quantum phases. There's also a very subtle issue of symmetry, and it highlights the role of symmetry in these quantum machine learning. And what can we explore? Combination two, I'm just gonna briefly go through this, maybe 2 points. Of course, we can also discover all the parameters in high dimensions, and this is not well understood. I mean, even in two dimensions, there are some phases of matter which we don't know how to distinguish. For example, the torical and double semion, they have the same Z2 topological data, except unless you look into the topological quantum field theory. Otherwise, it's really hard to distinguish these two, even by topological entanglement entropy, for example. And another interesting thing is to extend the previous construction of the phase transitions, but to more generic gap quantum phases using ISO-TNS. Can you connect them? And would this lead to more interesting examples which we can efficiently realize in an experiment? Okay. So with this, I would like to conclude my talk, and thanks for listening. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Leo, for the very interesting talk. Is there any question?
Yes.
Okay.
So can you prove that this convolutional neural network always work?
In one dimension, yes.
Meaning given enough system size, cube size?
Yes, yes. Because in one dimension, there's actually a same work that's posted by Sun Wan, Ethan Lake, and Shankar, which appears at the same time as our work, where they do not do this from training. They do this by analytics. So they can, for any given one-dimensional phases of matter, they can construct an exact analytical QZNN that can classify this space. But it only works for one dimension. In two dimensions, it's still open. There's no guarantee.
Can you say more about the symmetry of quantum data?
Mm-hmm. The symmetry of quantum data, so basically, there are two things that's very interesting. And so one is that the symmetry of the quantum, in this case, our quantum data, they are generated by applying symmetric perturbation to the fixed points, meaning that all the data we have, they inherently have the symmetries. And by doing so, the QZNN would spontaneous, well, which is already learned the universal feature that encodes a symmetry. And in fact, what I did not show here is that you can try to, you know, once you train the QZNN with symmetric data, you can test it on systems that break the symmetry. And you see that QZNN actually gets confused. Basically, all the probabilities for these phase, all the labels will have similar probability such that you cannot tell which one should be the correct prediction. Now, this is one comment on the symmetry. And the second is the translation invariant comment I make. That is, without any additional symmetry, such as translation invariant is not necessary. But if you don't have any additional symmetry other than a symmetry that's protecting your phase, then this randomly perturbed data will always scramble your training procedure such that you don't get any faithful solution of your QCNN via supervised training. So this is a no-go theorem. And this means that in order to have a solution, you really have to pay attention to what additional symmetry you improve, the different results as well. Yeah.
But what's the intuition behind this no-go theorem?
This is just that, so let's suppose you don't have translation invariance, right? And you don't have any additional symmetry, just say Z2 cross Z2 or anything like this. Then what happens is that you can apply spatially independent random unitary that respect Z2 cross Z2. Now, because these perturbations, they are spatially independent, they can scramble your system very randomly, such that if you evaluate any observable on this ensemble of states, they will always evaluate to some trivial number or up to symmetry. So this result means that there's no way that you can recover information from the ensemble by any observable you can construct, right? So basically this scrambling locally is just too bad. There's no useful information you can use to decode the information. There's no way you can decode the information using a single observable. You can do it with exponentially many observables. That's possible. Yeah.
Let's see. The last question is, in the last phase diagram, you wrote down some KT, some Coulomb. I suppose this is also some phase transition in the wave function, but not a phase transition of harmonic.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly correct. So that's some fine-tuned phase transition in the tensor networks because it's easier to simulate. But we also have several lines, data for several lines for the real 2D Z2 gauge lattice gauge Z2 gauge theory phase diagram, which we solve using variational tensor networks. Basically, that's really the ground state of the Hamiltonian of the familiar Z2 gauge theory. And then there, the tests show similar results. So you can also correctly tell roughly where the phase boundaries are. Of course, it's not perfect, but it captures the correct physics. But then there's only we can only do it for a few lines. We don't have the scans for the entire phase diagram because the difficulty of solving the ground states.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Do you think there's any limitations in like using QCN for this classification, or this is always scalable?
There's several open questions, as I mentioned, like for this QZNN. One is in high dimensions, it's never guaranteed there's a solution. So this is something that, you know, I think people some of us are actually thinking about how to prove the existence of solution, at least the existence of solution in high dimensions. Right? It doesn't have to be explicit, but there should be one. And this is one issue. And the second issue is that how sensitive is the QZNN, how sensitive is QZNN to noise perturbation, right? So if you implement this on a real device, it's unlikely you'll be noise-free, right? You always have noise, which can break translation variance, which can have noise in the circuits. And now the QZNN is a non-local object, right? So you just contract everything. It's like a RG flow. And because it's non-locality, the noise can potentially screw up everything. Even the noise is small because it propagates. But there are some evidence that suggests small noise will be fine for QZNN. But however, this is only a very vague evidence. So in general, it's an open question how sensitive QZNN is for noise. So this is actually a more realistic issue, I would say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have one more question. Is that how are you going to make sure that your unit tree respects gauge symmetry? Is that easy to do?
The unit tree respect what symmetry?
Gauge symmetry.
I don't. You mean for this example or what? I mean, unitary, they don't have, when you say gauge symmetry, what do you refer to?
For example, when you're constructing the learning of the QCNN, you are saying start with a fixed point and then apply unitary that respect the symmetry. I would
yes.
imagine the fixed point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I want to learn the torical phase, it's the gauge symmetry. Then how can I apply unitary that respect that?
You don't in torical you don't have any symmetry. So if you use the definition I mentioned, which is equivalence relation formed by local unitary circuits, the toric code is stable without any symmetry.
I see. So you in your system there will only be translation symmetry.
Yes. In the example I showed you, yes. So it's kind of amazing that it somehow recovers the EM duality. Well, at least roughly. Like he only knows about this guy and that guy. And then somehow it has like this side as well, which we don't fully understand yet. So there's no other symmetries that's involved in this thing. No gauge and no others. Yeah.
If not, let's thank Theo for this very interesting talk.